I'm going to talk to you about memory and C++ debugging at Electronic Arts. I'm going to talk to you about it in a bunch of eras. Basically, I'm going to talk about what we used to do back when game programming was more like embedded programming back in 2000 on PS2. Then I'll start talking about how things were back on 360 when we got virtual memory for the first time and ESDL came about. finally, I'm going to talk about things now with PS4 and Xbox One. And I'm going to show you a sneak peek of what our current sort of state-of-the-art debugging tools. This is me. I've been in games forever. I like to try and solve problems visually and draw pictures and do animations and stuff. That probably got me into games. And I'm badly dyslexic, so if you see any spelling mistakes, please let me know. I won't have noticed them. So on that note, let's start with vocabulary, one of my favorite topics. In memory debugging systems and things, I've always noticed that there seems to be a lot of different vocabularies around, like heaps and arenas and allocators and pools, and so this is what I'm going to use. I'm going to talk about allocators, and they will be a class that can free or allocate memory. Usually it's a pure virtual interface. And then I'm going to talk about arenas, and arenas are like a set of address ranges where you can find an allocator from it. And so you can go back and forth from an allocator to finding what address ranges is in, or you can take any particular pointer in memory and find out what arena that's in, and therefore you know what allocator it's from. And heap sometimes I'll say quite a bit, and that's kind of the combination of the two. So back in 2000, we just started converting from C. I mean, most people turned on their C++ compilers by this point. We didn't have any virtual memory. There was no OS. Very similar to embedded programming systems and very simple systems. Only 32 megs of RAM. So what I started seeing about how to get debugging information into the game and how to debug all of the allocations was like techniques like this one, where people would add news and deletes to all of their classes. This is actually a good idea for performance sake. I mean, people use like fixed sized pools and slabs of allocators where they bump pointers and things like that. But if you're trying to use this as a debug technique, it falls down because you're having to, if you don't do this somewhere, you won't really notice. If you don't override your new and delete in a location, then you just miss having the extra tracking information. We still have code like this around in EA, but it's something that I would suggest not to do. But I understand why library teams do it, because this is sometimes hard on a very large project. You want to use global new and global delete, but what interface do you use? What kind of debugging parameters do you use? In a very large company like EA, it was actually kind of tricky to get the politics of this right. Eventually, we settled on something like this, where we had some flags which said whether we were on the top of RAM or the bottom of RAM. And we had a debug name that would be associated with every single allocation. To understand how we use that debug name, you kind of have to understand what a heap looks like for us anyways. And usually it's got a header, an allocated block and a footer, and this is pretty simple. But we would store in the footer this debug name, and we would put it there and be, fresh for being corrupted, because that's usually what the memory you would corrupt. Maybe not the best of places to put it. And it would look like this. It would be like category :: allocator. So we would have things like, rendering :: player or gameplay :: physics mesh or those kind of things, and we would store it there. And this was pretty good tech, we thought, and it was good. It was simple back then because we didn't really have very many pools or anything because there wasn't that much RAM, only tens of thousands of objects, I guess. We did have a small block allocator, and this wasn't quite used everywhere, but pretty close. And we had to work really hard at fragmentation. And we thought this was the height of technology at the time. You would load compressed blocks in the bottom of RAM and then decompress them and put them in the top of RAM, and that's what we would use those flags for, is for doing things like this. And you ping-pong things back and forth to get rid of all of the fragmentation. And this worked pretty well as long as you only had one CPU. Once, of course, we went to Xbox 360 and PS3, our world had to change, though. We had virtual memory now, though, and this was a real good advantage. You didn't have a hard drive, though, so we couldn't really use it the same way everybody else could. And the GPUs couldn't support it, and that's where a lot of our memory actually went. So it wasn't perfect, but it was definitely an improvement. Having all of those CPUs meant that we wanted to have more allocation systems and divide memory up a little bit more so we didn't have contention on it, and fragmentation would become sort of a higher level problem. We needed better tracking and logging systems. And we invented something we call the stomp allocator, and that was a huge advance in how we debugged memory corruption. Finally, STL came into existence, and this really algorithmically changed the way we worked. And that was really powerful. But how did we deal with having multiple allocators? For the most part, it's pretty simple. I mean, you just pass an extra parameter to your new operator, and it can kind of work. And that's what we did. Delete, however, is a pain. And so, therefore, we had to wrap it in a macro and a crazy amounts of technology to pass in an extra parameter in order to call the appropriate destructor. We still use that code today, and occasionally we think, why don't we have it so we can pass in an extra parameter delete? Might be nice. We also had to think about, how are we going to divide up memory? How do we decrease fragmentation if we can't sort of ping-pong back and forth as much? So what we did was we kind of divided it based on time, is sort of the most important, and size. And by time, I mean like static allocations. They allocate once and they never get freed. Global allocations, they have a lifetime longer than a level anyways, and so they're passing information between levels, like your front-end system or something like that. And you'd have sub-level information that, maybe a cutscene that happens during a level. And the level pool could just disappear after a level was done, and so you could figure out that your whole system was in a steady state. You'd also have various types of temporary allocations for things like, okay, bullets are flying around. They only last for a few frames. We'd also do things by size, too, where you just like your cupboards or something like that, you take all your big pots and pans and you put them into one location, and you take all of your smaller ones and put them somewhere else. We had the small block allocator, like I was talking about, and that's actually a completely custom system. But we actually would even just use general allocators and put different size things in different directions, and this actually reduced fragmentation. One thing that it sort of depended on the size of team that we had, whether we did this or not, but we'd also break it up kind of on the boundaries, the political boundaries, if you will, of the team. And you would then have like generic heaps and small block allocator heaps for each team. This is actually a performance disadvantage, really, and smaller teams wouldn't want it. But big teams did, because it was very easy to set blame for things. If you were on a smaller team, you'd probably do something like this and just tag the allocations based on categories. And you can see that there's, you can just count up the orange blocks and count up the red blocks. And you could see how much memory was being taken up and set budgets based on that. And that's a really good thing to do. But, you're going to have things like fragmentation. And fragmentation, is hard. Like, who's at fault? Who did it? And when you have things like memory corruption, between teams, it's quite interesting too. You know, your shadows are suddenly being corrupted. Of course you're gonna blame the rendering team. They wrote the shadow system, it must be their fault. But they're gonna be pretty upset at you when you told them to fix their bugs and then they figure out that it's actually, you know, people writing the sim code and they went in and corrupted one of their buffers. And so that's really too bad. Along the same line, we started to notice that it was important to keep our debugging information safe from the rest of our system. There was some really important information there, and we could use it to determine what was actually going on around the corruption. You could, you know, memory effectively looked like this, and you had, you know, the traditional header, allocated block, footer, normal heap there, and you would have a separate heap that was a debug heap that you would track by address, and that address would be a hash key. So it was kind of like a hash table that would be implemented. And you would use that hash in order to figure out how to free it. So it wasn't completely free, what we were able to do there, but this concept of tracking all of our live allocations somewhere else safe meant that when you saw corruption in a rendering block or something like that, you could take it, dump it out after you crashed, look at the previous block, and find out, oh, it's a gameplay block, and it's this size, and you'd know a bunch of properties about it, and then you could write code to test for bugs and things based on it, and that was really good. You'll notice that there's something else going on here. There's this whole memory logging system as well. We would take maybe we wouldn't be able to run the whole game this way, but sections of the game anyways, maybe one pool at a time or one team's worth of memory at a time, and stream it out to disk, change by change, every single transaction we did with the memory system, and write it out so we'd know where every alloc and free was. And we would do this so that we could write a tool like this one, where you can see the, you know, the start of time to end of time, and you can see that memory is slowly going up here, right? This is our game going through boot flow as we go through a bunch of changes and we load various files. You can sort of see what's going on. You can, here, you could pick any particular point in time and you could see a snapshot of what was going on and see it down in the spreadsheet below. But the other thing you could do is you could select regions and you could see the delta changes that happened there besides just seeing a whole snapshot. And you would have, you know, information like you would expect to be able to debug the system. You would have, you know, the heap it was from, the category it was in, allocation names, the number of count of items and allocation sizes. You could also get a call stack as well. But that isn't in this diagram. You could also see like a block of diagram of it, and you could see the thing I was talking about before with categories. You could see that the systems guys are all allocated over there, and the presentation information is down in purple there. You can see that we have some fragmentation in this heap because gray is free, and you can see there's more than one section of gray. And you could highlight blocks and find out, you know, attributes about it, you know, what the size of this block was, where it was in memory, and you could see things that were going on around it. And if you had memory corruption or something like that, this was very useful to sort of reason about what was going on. The other thing that we added was something called Stomp Allocator. Of course, we're working on consoles, so we can't use the same teams, the same tools that everybody else would, like Valgrind and things like this. So we end up inventing some of our own. I think this one is similar to Electric Fence, where we would use the virtual memory system to allocate a read-write page and then a read-only page right afterwards, and we would stuff our allocation right at the bottom. And if we, you know, had an array inside there and you walked off, you would immediately crash and stop and you would get a call stack and you would know exactly where your bug was. And we could find tons of memory corruption with this tool. Now, because we over-allocate using the system, we couldn't use it everywhere. I mean, we have no memory left. I mean, when you're working on an Xbox 360, especially near the end of its life cycle, we were scraping back memory by, you know, reducing code space and all sorts of craziness. So how we use these tools is we would have all the attributes of allocations, and we would only apply them to a small set at a time. So as we saw memory corruption happening in particular regions, we could turn this on to, you know, all gameplay allocations that are between 256 bytes to, you know, maybe 300 bytes or something like that, a very small range of memory, and we could test it. One other thing I learned around this time was the pains of ref pointers. I first saw them and I was thought, oh, great, I should use these everywhere, and I started to. And as quickly as I started to use them everywhere, I ran into this problem. And I started ripping them out as fast as I could, and I never wanted to use them again. But I've learned my lesson now. Really, they are very useful, especially in multi-threaded situations, things like that. I think I would start with unique pointer or bare pointers to start, because I've got these great debugging systems to track all these allocations. You know, fighting memory leaks really isn't that hard for me. What's hard is tracking down circular dependencies, because I'm not really set up for it. I might be able to solve this problem. I think it's called garbage collection. I'm pretty sure I would start from there, because I think they've solved it quite well. I could implement a logging system too. I mean, I could log every single, you know, add ref and dec ref in my entire system, but that's going to be a lot of memory, way more than the number of blocks of memory I have, because the number of blocks of memory, I have so many more pointers, and how many times I use those pointers is how many times I might end up inc refing and dec refing. So the other thing that happened at this time was STL. There's a lot of reasons why we decided to use STL and not use standard. The standard library, we ended up inventing our own ESTL. But basically, it came down to speed for our particular case. This is on Visual Studio 2015. But it's kind of been the same for quite a while. I tried it on 2012 as well, and the results are a little similar. This is a bunch of tests. This is a benchmark. And so I don't know, maybe the benchmark isn't that good. But out of the 188 tests that I had, 71 cases, we are 30% faster. There's 10 which we're slower, and we know what they are. You know, they're not cases that we normally use, or we wanted to go for memory or something instead. With the debug case, it's really interesting, actually. We're way faster. We're way faster because we cut and paste more code. The inliner doesn't really work when you have functions that call other functions that call other functions. And so it isn't really that good. So we just kind of flattened the whole thing. Hopefully we got it right and didn't write that many bugs, because I'm guessing that's why, you know, STL when things don't do that. One thing is really cool is we're going to open source ESTL, like, for real. Yay. So Rob over here is going to take pull requests and things once we get all set up. Keep an eye on this place here on GitHub, and you'll see it soon. We'll talk about the details to the SG14 group, and I don't know. We just barely decided all this stuff, so hopefully I'm not causing any trouble with this. But even though we invented our own version of STL, we didn't all think of the same thing and the same vision, I guess. You know, allocators, for example, do you want them to be polymorphic or do you not? Well, we couldn't decide on that. Ours had state and things in them, so we had more something towards the allocators that are in 2011. So we could use them sort of like this, where we would be able to override and use our iCore allocators, which is our allocation interface, and we could use them everywhere. And this worked okay. It was not bad. But you had this problem. You have a lot of default parameters. And if you keep things exactly the same interface as STL, which is what we wanted to do, you had to pass in all of this stuff that you didn't want to pass in. And so it was a pain to use. You know, this is okay, but it's not great. Another way to solve the problem was this. You could have your vector, and you could call getAllocator, and then setAllocator on it, and change it each time. And the STL, the way it works is you guarantee that it will not allocate memory right away. It will only allocate memory once you push something into it. And so that worked okay. And our team's a pretty big team, and so sometimes we think we can get away with just changing the interface. And we shouldn't at least try to do these bad ones. So this was me. I added it. Our system allows us to look up allocators by name. And so I decided that was a good idea, and that was not a good idea. And fortunately, nobody took it, and it should die one of these days, but there's a lot of code that looks like that. The other thing that happens with allocators and things is this kind of problem. I'm guessing many people would know the problem here. Does people know what the problem here is? This is compiler, doesn't work. They're different types, right? They're both vectors of type int, but because their allocators are different, it doesn't know what to do, and so it explodes. So we invented another thing. This is only internally, and so I don't know if we're going to make this public, but I think we should, because it's not a bad idea. We took and wrapped all of STL. I wouldn't suggest that everybody does this, but if you've got a large enough system, maybe this is an idea. And we changed the order of parameters for ourselves so that we could pass in the information. And we made sure that the allocator was always first, because I was telling all the engineers, you have to pass in an allocator. Of course, they would tell me that, you know, if I have to pass in an allocator to everywhere, it's really hard to write my map of list of strings. And then I would say, please do not write a map of list of strings. At least use a hash table of, you know, vectors of strings. That sort of thing worked well enough. It was sort of good. And it got people, like if I gave it to a junior engineer, they could figure it out. We continued it for a bit more so that we could, for a large system, if you were writing like 70 files or something like this, C files or something, things on this scale starts making sense or so, where you could make your own string type for that large system. So in our career mode case, we would make a new string type for it. And we would know that we just wanted to use the same allocator each time, and it was fine. It was close enough. And because of the way we did the inheritance here, you can see it's inheriting from STL vector in this case, although it probably should be string, I guess. we could, the inheritance, because this would work out, the allocators are the same, the type's the same, and I don't get a compiler error anymore. And so now I can transfer the types between them. This will copy the data, so from the localization string, and it would copy it into the career mode string. And that's what we wanted to achieve, because localization is supposed to be sort of like a factory. And so therefore, it's supposed to be producing strings for the other system. And career mode should be owning it, because it has a duration of time. Career mode starts and it ends. And so therefore, I can tell if all the strings got freed at some point, and I can write systems that prove that's the case. And so this fixes my ownership issue, which is quite useful. So now we're off to today. So today, we obviously have even more memory. We have 64-bit addresses, so that's really good. We have hard drives on all of the consoles, so we're allowed to use them now. The GPUs are not quite virtual memory, but they're getting close, and we're even allowed to not have linear textures for them, and so that's really good. So that means our debugging system should change again. And ESDL tracking, we took another crack at it, and finally, I'm going to talk about our new debugging tools that we've been developing in-house. So one thing that started happening around this time is, you know, that people started throwing out the debug name. It started not necessarily being the way we wanted to solve problems. We still passed in an iCore allocator pointer everywhere, so we still had our polymorphic allocator everywhere. But we wanted to do things like this, where we wanted to associate a lot more data with our allocations, not just associate a debug name, because before we would, you know, associate a debug name and say if we loaded a file, we might make the debug name equal to the file, but we couldn't tell that it was a resource or something like that, or this came from this resource. And with scopes, we could. So scopes is maybe the way we should go. I mean, we have to use more thread local storage and things, and so there's some performance-related problems there, but we started using scopes quite a bit, and most of the debug information that we're trying to push in now is going this way. We still have the old interfaces. Of course, nothing ever dies, but it's working pretty well. So our code kind of looks like this. We passed in an allocator. We knew a team. ESTL is sort of still a problem. It's not quite fitting. I mean, we invented this EA Stelica. I guess I didn't say it. Estelica, by the way, is supposed to be pronounced like Metallica. And it's E-A-S-T-L I-Core Allocator. Sorry, I didn't explain that before, but it's brutal to pronounce. So what we started to do with ESTL, like, because we wanted to solve it in a cleaner way, you could have an arena, like a gameplay arena or a level arena. It doesn't really matter which. And you could allocate, you know, your team, your home team or whatever. And maybe it has a team ID and a vector of players. And of course, everyone knows what a vector is going to have in it. It's going to have an allocator, which might be 0 bytes. You know, first, last, end pointer. But what you can do is you could check what arena that allocator would have been in. And you can do this really fast, and probably everybody can do it this day really fast, is because if you've got delete to work and it's going really fast, you must have global delete. You must have some way to implement global delete and look up your pointer and figure out how you should free this global pointer. And so because every team could implement this, this means we could use that information as a parameter to decide where the players should go. It didn't have to be exactly the same pool. I mean, we could do slightly different things. We could decide that players should go in a small block allocator, for example. But if you think about this, you know, who owns, what team owns this information? Well, probably it's the same people that created it. What lifetime is it going to have? Well, the team's created it. Players probably live as long as the team, maybe. You know, well, that's you know, probably making a pretty good guess. At least it's better than what we were doing before. I mean, what would we do before? I mean, we would just allocate these things in global and be done with it, I guess. And that's really wrong. There's lots of interesting little problems with this. I mean, it's not free. You have to spend some time to look up what arena this thing's in. Is that a great thing to do? I don't know. Move operators. Obviously, if you want to change ownerships between systems, it's not going to work. It's going to move the vector, but it's not going to move the underlying allocation of all of the players. But it works 80% of the time, and maybe that's good enough. You made it. You own it. Not a bad rule. For other cases, maybe you could use an Estelica-like pattern. That's a good idea. You know, for a factory, like localization or something like that, where you didn't want to keep ownership of everything you created. Maybe that's a good idea. So finally, I'm going to talk about Delta Viewer, which is a tool we've been working on internally to show how we've combined together all of our debugging tools and tried to be able to see them in one environment and try and show you why we need that. And what we do is we debug sessions of data. And a session, what I mean by that is when you play a game, you keep playing it until you crash or quit. And crashing is actually fairly common when you're working on it. So And all of this data, you stream it out to the SE's machine. And there's a server that runs on each SE's machine to collect up all of this data, or on the QA's machine if it's being run by QA. All this data is stored in tables, and these tables are then in view, so it's basically a database on everybody's machine. But that's actually really useful because we can build these views around it and have all of these views work with each other. So some of our popular views are sort of like a printf TTY channel kind of like thing. We have IO profiling, so load profiling, frame rates, jobs profiling, threads, those kind of information. We also have a memory investigator tool, which helps us see changes in memory over time. And we have another sort of categorization system. And the categorization system sort of groups together allocations and allows us to see things at a high scale. So with TTY, even just TTY systems, you get kind of an interesting thing going on here. You can see channels, and in this case, I'm looking at only one channel, and this is LTC, which is load time channel. And so I can see when load time started and ended in this game. And I can see when level 2 happened. I know the data very well, and that's why I'm having to highlight it. And so I've got a primitive little profiler right here. And so that's kind of cool. That's a neat idea all on its own. And it's nice to get the printfs off of the machine, because printfs are actually, on some consoles, are very, very expensive. But of course, that's a pretty primitive thing, and maybe you'd want a more better version of a load profiler. And this is what we have, and it's actually maybe overly complicated, but I'll give you the highlights anyways, which is there's this load profiler, and it has a timeline there, and time goes from one side to the other. And we have this concept called bundles, and we group together files that we're going to load together, and then we load them all at once. And this is better for seeks and things. We also have things like chunks, which like parts of movies and parts of video, and terrain and open world games and that sort of thing, like sort of sub parts of files. And bundles really tell me when I'm going to get in my next level or sub level. And so usually they're kind of, when they're done, then you're finished loading. And what you can do with these two views, the TTY channels and the load time profilers, you can combine them together. You can see the printfs in the load time view, and you can see when they happen. And this is like adding events to it, and that's really cool. You can see when you were loading level one. You can see when you're playing the game. You can see when you're playing level two. You can see when you're loading level two, when you're playing level two. And you can see that I haven't actually finished loading when I'm playing, which is kind of odd, and I probably should have done. If you actually played the game, unfortunately, I don't have a video to go with it. It's a feature we're going to add, but we haven't done yet. If you hover over top of that file, you can find out that crowds aren't loaded yet. And if you're playing the game, you could actually see that the crowds sort of pop in as the game was playing, and that isn't very good. We fixed that bug, and that was good. Next thing is as a load profiler. And if you know anything about games, of course, games are broken up into frames. And the height of each one of these things is a frame. And so higher it is, worse it is. And so in this case, that is a very expensive frame, and that is not allowed. You gotta hammer that guy down somehow or another. You can highlight what's going on there, and that's what's going on there in blue, is I actually highlighted this one. And all of that information shows up down there at the bottom. And you can see this expensive frame. You can see when it started and when it ended, and you can see it's slightly bigger than all the rest. All of that noise there is a thing called jobs, and jobs, let's just call them callbacks that happen on another thread. And then you can see the function stacks as you pop back and forth, happening over and over. They're not complete call stacks, but most of it is there. One thing I noticed, because I know this game really well, and in some games this is not the case, but we shouldn't be waiting for render. A lot of games are highly coupled. Our game can slide back and forth 3 or 4 frames between our rendering and our sim. And so I shouldn't have this. All of these yellow things should be gone, and this particular yellow happened to be really expensive because the GPU was a little slow. And once I removed all of the yellow, everything ran a whole lot better. But you can still combine together more of these views. And you need to do this because during load time, the whole machine is running. You're not just spinning the disk and trying to load things up. You have to load things, and then you'll have to decompress them because loading compressed things are faster. And then you'll have the texture or whatever, and you'll start stomping names or something on it with a font. And then from there, because the writing the names is easy in 32 bits or whatever, you want to compress it down and make it a smaller type of texture because the GPU would be happier to run on that smaller type. And the color reduction and stuff is just going to work. Sometimes that is done in the GPU, but a lot of these things are CPU limited. So you can see here in 4K glory, which is really hard to read for everybody, but you get the idea. That I've got TurboTuner up at the top. I've got my frame rate meter there. And I can view all of what's going on in all of the CPUs. I can highlight what's going on the TurboTuner to see what's going on and what file I/O is going on in a particular location. And what I'll see is these frames are bad, and I can see what file I/O is going on there, or I can see around this file I/O, is my frame rate good? What kind of processing is happening right after these files? And I can do it either way. So no matter which one I select, the other one gets selected at the same time. And all of that ends up showing up on the bottom. And I can see what's going on and see my one big frame and what's going on in every single CPU and the GPU as well. In this case, I actually don't know what the bug is yet. I haven't figured that out. So I'll have to spend some more time on it. But soon. Now, memory is kind of an interesting thing, especially memory leaks. It's funny. If you just Google memory leaks, you'll get some strange advice. And they say, hey, make sure that you free all of your memory when you shut it down. And I'm always like, really? I don't know. I just delete my process. The OS is better at it than me. I mean, it's not that doing that in debug mode or something isn't useful, I guess. But really what you want is to put the machine in some steady state and make sure that you never go above certain high water marks and stuff. Because, if you're working on consoles, you only have so much memory, and you don't want to lose performance and swap things out to disk or something like that. So the way I look at memory leaks, what I would call a memory leak, is I capture allocations between a particular period of time. Like, okay, loading level 1 from the beginning of the load to the end of the load. I've probably loaded most of my big assets there for the level. And then I can make sure that those are unloaded by the time I'm getting to level 2. Because I don't want that high watermark. So, for example, if I've got this allocation at time T1, I want to make sure that it's freed before C. In this case, it's freed after C. It is freed, but it's still a leak because it's adding to my high watermark. I said it was going to be free, and it is not. And so I need to go dig into this and find out what that problem is. So what you can do is you can look at TurboTuner, and you can determine where A, B, and C are. You can go find out that, my level 1 loading is here. And by C, all of those allocations better be gone. And then you can see that I've got a big list of memory leaks here, which kind of sucks. But fortunately, I have good information. I know what scope they're from. I know what their pointer, their size. I know their call stack IDs. I know a highlighted item, which the full call stack there. I'll know what assets were associated with that location. So I have lots of all of this sort of metadata with each allocation. And so that's really powerful. I can see other things besides just this sort of ABC memory leak thing. There's other modes, and I can do similar things to the previous tool where I can, you know, just highlight 2 points and see what growth I had or something like that. But I think this is pretty useful. You can also do memory categorization with this tool. And this is data-driven, and you can sort of scrub between two times. You can, you know, start before the level's loaded and after the level loaded, and you can see how much memory goes up. In this case, you know, it goes from 2.6 gigs to 3.3 or so. I think this is kind of interesting because, you know, everybody kind of wonders what goes on in games, and really I think they're very similar to a lot of programs. And, you know, I have 2.2 million allocations. 2.1 are smaller than 512 bytes. So this means my debugging systems, really I'm focused on this number here. I have to figure out how I'm going to debug this large number of small block allocations and deal with that scale. On the other hand, my memory leak system, when I'm trying to figure out, you know, am I going to run out of RAM or something, I really should pay attention to the higher numbers where I've only got 208 allocations and somehow or another that adds up to 2 gigs. That was surprising for me. But these are allocations that are larger than 2 megs. So, you know, they're big. And I think that happens with many programs. There's sort of this exponential curve that goes on. The other thing is like I was saying, this is data-driven. So by loading another YAML file, I can look at it in a different way. I could see how many cars and how much cars took up. I could see how much trees take up. I could see, you know, how much any particular element that I wanted to in my game, bullets, weapons, you know, towns, I don't know, car parks. I can also see and show to you what, you know, most games are sort of made out of. Most of their memory is really about rendering and about assets. And by assets, I mean meshes and textures for the most part. One thing for me that when I did this experiment surprised me quite a bit is how many other allocations I had. I mean, I've got, you know, 1.2 million allocations and assets. And if they're supposed to be big things, what's going on there? There's actually a whole bunch of entities that glue all of these things together in our engine, and a lot of them are very small, and there's obviously quite a few of them, and that's what's going on in this case. Rendering assets are quite similar to content in the fact that they're nearly like textures and buffers used to draw the scene, and those buffers sometimes are a lot like meshes, actually. Another thing that people should note is that code is small compared to all of this, and so data is usually the problem. If you can reformat your data and make data faster or data better, then this is a good idea. Trying to figure out how you can compress and make data smaller is usually what you should be focused on. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I don't know, 3 months ago I was scraping code out of ESTL and trying to shrink our executable size back on PowerPC. On Gen 3, so PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360. I mean, so it does happen, and sometimes that is the best way to get back memory. But usually you should look at data first. So I've introduced Delta Viewer, and I've shown you all of the different views that we've got. I've also shown you that I've got lots of work left to do. Fortunately, I have a year left, so I'm OK. I've taught a little about the differences that we've had between ESTL and STL and how we're trying to track all of that memory and how we're trying to figure out how to debug it. And maybe using something like you made it, you own it kind of style might be a good idea. ESTLica might be another way to solve this problem. It's an idea. I'm not sure if it's entirely fully baked, but it does seem to work pretty well. And I can give it to a junior engineer, and they will solve it and figure it out right away. And so that's quite good. Finally, I hope you learned a little bit about games in general, you know, what they're made out of, how much memory we have, and they're pretty much similar to most styles of things. Lots of small allocations, not so many big ones. most of its rendering and assets. You might also have seen that, you know, if you don't have things like stomp allocators, you really should be using them. But I guess if you're on, you know, things like Macs and PCs, then you probably even have better tools than I do. There's a lot of different ways of having large amounts of allocation schemes, and we really do pay attention to it and divide up memory in all sorts of ways based on team or size or you know, time of life. Besides just the ones that everybody talks about here, where, you know, it's about performance, you know, fixed size pools and you know, bump pointer allocators and these kind of things. But I think that's it for me. Thanks. Anybody have any questions or anything? Want a mic? I don't know. Yeah.
So there were a couple.
Is that on?
Yeah, I don't know if this is on.
It is on.
Okay. Cool. All right. Yes.
There were a few other things that you showed in the talk, such as EA Stelica and the Profiler.
The Profiler will not be open sourced, not yet anyways. Don't know if that'll change.
It looked really cool.
Oh, yeah, thanks. It is pretty neat. I wanted to show people what we do internally. I wish, hope maybe Stelica or something like that can be. I don't know. I'll work on it. Behind the scenes, and we'll see. I know I've just gotten the ability to do STL, but I think there is some momentum there, and so maybe there'll be other things that we'll be able to do. I don't know.
Thanks.
Sad to hear that you're not going to open sources, but the next best thing, is there any chance to see the features you showed here in screenshots or something like that, videos? So we can copy that to other tools like HeapTrack, which I'm working on for Linux heap profiling.
I wish I could have done a live demo. I probably could have got away with a live demo, except for the fact that I'm working on a very tiny Mac, and as you saw, it really likes screen space. It's like 4K is pretty good. I mean, I can do it in HD, but yeah, no. I'm sorry, I didn't make any videos or anything of it. It's pretty new, actually. We just got it internally. I would think, like, the memory stuff we just got in July. So, I mean, it is really our cutting edge. So, as of yet, I don't know what we'll do with it. So, sorry. Yeah.
Does ESTL also work with, like, the standard memory smart pointers, like unique pointer and shared pointer, or are they completely off of those, or do they have their own implementation of those newer features?
We would have our own implementations of those features as well, and we'll usually put things in ESTL to try and make it like the standard. You would know better than me, but... Oh, okay. Yeah, come talk to him, and he can tell you more details about it. I'm a power user more than I'm an implementer. So. Anything else?
Hello. First of all, thanks, Scott, for that talk. Mm-hmm. Mimics. I work at Creative Assembly. Actually, we have spoken before. I'm Guy Davidson.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Hello.
Hey.
You know, what you were covering mimics most of what the pains that we've been through at Creative Assembly as well. So it's nice to know it's not just us and that we probably are on the right track as well.
Uh-huh.
The particular question I had was that you were describing how Dinkumware's debug performance was substantially worse than the EASTL performance.
That's true.
Which we also discovered with our own CASTL.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah, this could get complicated. But we discovered fairly quickly that this was down to the iterator debug level, and I wondered if you'd taken account of that.
What is it?
Iterator debug level.
No, in our case, it's not. I've shut off all of, like, the parameters and everything are fairly optimal. You know, I am trying to give it a fair fight. You know, I wasn't trying to disable all these things. I don't know if I left the debug one in the default. I'm pretty sure, though, that even in the debug case, that I've turned off all of the default debug attributes and things like that, and I'm not doing, you know, checking to see if I'm off the end or all of those kind of things that you could do in SDL by default.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
There's one up there too.
I can project my voice. I hope.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, want to, sorry. Yeah, back right, up top, there. Yeah.
Hey, thanks. So do you have sort of similar empirical data for how the adoption of these tools actually reduced the bug count? In terms of number of bugs or time taken to resolve them on your team?
I'm not sure, actually. I know, like, Stomp Allocator was, like, a revolution in the fact that, like, I could just, I started ignoring QA, and I would just go and try and test with this thing, and only once I got rid of all the bugs that way that I would start, you know, paying attention to you know, QA's bug reports, because I would know more about the status of the game than they do. But besides that sort of non-empirical data, I don't have very much.
For EASTL, were there any, you know, intrinsic decisions that allowed you to increase the performance as much as you did for certain cases, or how were you able to get, you know, such big speed ups in certain cases?
I probably would have to go look at Paul Pedriana's paper. I know we were talking about it on the way in. I think one has to do with the memory model of STL versus ESTL. I think we're allowed to have pointers as being our iterators in strings and in vectors. So that's one place. And the other place is we don't rely on inlining as much. We do more cutting and pasting. And I think those two count for much of the performance difference off the top of my head. But I didn't have time to go dig into the numbers, because that I knew everybody wanted to know, but I haven't had time to go into the numbers as much.
Hi. I wanted to ask about intrusive containers.
Okay, and, yes, we have those.
Do you have intrusive containers for all container types, or some subset, or?
Yeah, we only have some subset. We don't have all of them. Do you know which ones we have? I think we have, I can only think of list. Yeah. Yeah.
We've been struggling at Blizzard to get intrusive version of chained hash map.
Okay. Interesting.
I'm curious if that was one of the ones that you had tackled yet.
Not yet, but that would be interesting. We do have many other things, but that don't get into ESDL. Like, people still write their own custom hash tables and things. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're definitely interested in adding intrusive containers as the next move for SG14. So people interested, contact me.
Yeah. If you guys get them into, you know, SG14, we'll pull them probably into ESDL.
I just wanted to say that the profiler you showed is very impressive. It has a lot of similarities to Windows Performance Analyzer.
That it does.
And I suspect that the logs that you generate could be turned into ETL files and opened, and much of the functionality could be...
Or I could use dtrace, too.
Of course, yes. But that's not getting open source. That could be an alternative for the rest of us.
And there is actually an internal library, and probably, like... There's two forces going on, actually. I bet you this might become a GUI for another thing. I can see it happen. As I wrote this, I posted this, and like one of my coworkers is like,
I want to work on that. I want to do this cool thing with D-Trace. And we're like, ah. Yeah.
What was all this tracking turned on? How much slower is your game?
Ha, I can't turn it all on at once.
Well,
sorry.
The settings you use normally, like for this visualization.
I'm actually surprised at how fast it is, actually. Like, for example, when we first converted over to the, you know, every single alloc and free sort of model that is in that tool, I was like, well, in our previous system, we were only able to turn it on just like certain zones at a time. Now I can turn it on everywhere. And, you know, what is it? You know, maybe 10% or something. It's actually really impressive how fast that particular one. The profiling one could use maybe a bit more work, mainly because, like the things we were talking about D-Trace and other tools like that, we could probably get better information than we currently have, and maybe we could implement those better. But, you know, they're usable in, you know, you're going to lose 3 or 4 milliseconds a frame or something to them. That's not too bad. I can still play my game in real time ish, as long as you can afford to drop some frames.
You showed quite a number of impressive tools. I'm just curious, mm-hmm. What portion of the team's time is spent on tool development as opposed to game development?
It's very small. And very big teams could afford to write some of their own tools, but in this case, this is one of a good reasons to start using, you know, engines. And you can see why what's going on in the gaming community is there's becoming less and less engines because just tooling up for these things is very expensive.
Hi. So now that you have all this logging, are you looking at using this to catch regressions in your code?
Sorry?
Store logs over time, see,
yes.
You know, stuff getting bigger.
Yeah, there's a whole other sort of thing that goes on here that I'm not showing. I mean, there's a project we call Biometrics because it came from BioWare, where we can see all of this data over time, over many, many sessions as well. So, but it's... Yeah, it seems like it's per team at the moment because teams need different types of data. They look at the problem differently still. Maybe eventually we'll be able to make it more central.
Cool. Okay, thank you.
We're over.
Very much. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.